This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
DIY and How Studios presents from Toronto, Canada, Muses and Stuff with your hosts, Shanti and Lynx. Part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Network of podcasts. Music. Culture. Technology and rock and roll. So grab those backstage passes and let's get to the show.
Today's guest is Kristen Casey, author of the book Rock Monster, My Life with Joe Walsh. Yep, that's Joe Walsh, a wildly, emphasis on wildly, talented musician and songwriter. He's also a member, or was a member, of the Eagles and Ringo Starr and his all-star band, just to name a few.
Yes. We spoke with Kristen about her serious long-term relationship with Joe Walsh, but as is the Muses' tradition, we get into so much more with our Muse du jour.
We talk about the spiritual connection between the Muse and the musician, our mutual love of Miss P, Pamela DeBar, understanding the male psyche, objectification that's consensual, and the importance of nurturing female sexuality.
We also get into what it's like to spend quality time with a Beatle, her crazy bond with Lee Von Helm, the writing process of her book, and her journey into her profession of surrogate partner and intimacy coach.
We had so much fun with Kristen and definitely believe that she is one of our soul sisters. We hope that you get just as much out of this as we did. Enjoy the show. Support for today's show comes from Simple Contacts. Simple Contacts is the most convenient way to renew your contact lens prescription and reorder your brand in minutes. I got LASIK eye surgery before I knew about Simple Contacts, but Lynx has been wearing them.
Yes, I recently took their 5-minute self-guided vision test online in my own living room. All you need is your current contacts and internet connection. You can use your computer or even your cell phone and 10 feet of space. And if you happen to be out of contacts, they've got an option to cover you as well. It was really easy to follow and much quicker than I expected it to be.
The test is only $20 and was designed by ophthalmologists. Licensed doctors review all tests, so while you get to skip the pricey office visit, you aren't skipping out on the care. And if you have an unexpired prescription and need more contacts, you can even skip the vision test and just upload a photo of the prescription or your doctor's information and order your lenses. All the hard work is done for you. Remember, this isn't a replacement for periodic full eye health exams. Simple Contacts tests your current prescription to ensure you're still seeing 20/20 and lets you order your contacts with zero hassle.
I was super impressed with their brand selection and how many types of lenses they offer. I easily found the brand my doctor had previously prescribed me, and in no time, they were on their way to me. I was also really impressed with their customer support team. You can text them direct and actually speak with a human. No automated robot systems to go through.
The reviews really speak for themselves. Simple Contacts has been rated 5 stars over 5,000 times on the App Store. Their contact lens prices are unbeatable. Standard shipping is free. And best of all, we're offering a promotion to our listeners.
You can get $20 off your contacts by going to simplecontacts.com/muses, M-U-S-E-S, or enter the code MUSES at checkout.
Once again, you can get $20 off your contacts by going to simplecontacts.com/muses or enter the code MUSES at checkout. That's M-U-S-E-S.
Cool. So you open your book with a story about being a teenager and hearing Joe Walsh on the radio and just being overcome with that feeling that you had this undeniable connection. And I've definitely felt this before with musician exes who, you know, you hear them and you're like, I know this. I feel this. And we've also read other books by muses who had similar experiences where they just had a connection and they couldn't explain it. What is your take on this? Is there a spiritual connection between the muse and the musician?
Well, yeah, I definitely think so. I really do. And, you know, between me and Joe, that was really what I had felt from the beginning. And I feel like muses and musicians are two sides of the same coin. Like, they sort of can't really exist or flourish without each other. And so they're this sort of ideal yin-yang balance, you know, like you have this feminine receptive energy in the muse. And if she doesn't have her counterpart, you know, she's going to wither. She's not ever going to have the opportunity to sort of express, you know, that best side of herself or that, just that side of herself. And then, you know, a musician or any kind of creative, I think the pressure on somebody who is a creative, especially someone who's doing that for a living, like, you know, like a musician or whatever, and if they don't, the pressure and the performance anxiety and the songwriting, like the performance anxiety just in songwriting, not necessarily being on stage, because on stage you have your fans, but, you know, having a muse to sort of immerse yourself in and be inspired by and sort of it takes them out of themselves for this projection into the future or, you know, that idea of performance. And it just becomes this thing that they're getting from or doing for their muse. And so it flows more naturally. And so to me, creativity, okay, so let's start there. Like, to me, creativity is godlike. You know, like when I think of God, definitely, I think of the creator, right? So what is more godlike in this world than being a creative person? You know, that is the closest I think a person in a way can get to expressing that godlike side of themselves. And if the muse is their inspiration and is allowing them to tap into that and to sort of step out of that fear-based, ego-based, you know, what if I fail, or this has to be good, you know, or what will my fans think, or the record company, you know, if they have a muse and she's inspiring them, then it's all for just the beauty of the creation, and they can, and then that's when it's going to come out the best. And so I just feel like, yeah, I definitely think there's a spiritual connection. I think that, you know, I know people, I've heard many stories, I've read stories, and I know people personally who have nothing to do with the arts and, you know, accountants and my favorite Whole Foods clerk, in fact, told me this story about when she saw her husband for the first time across the room and she felt it, like, in her body. I mean, I think that it just, and she's empathic, I know, and she's a friend of mine, kind of, and so there's that, like, I think it's a thing that happens all across the board, but people who, you know, more, you know, the general population tend to dismiss things they don't really understand, or that just seem, you know, weird, or I don't know, freakish, or if it hasn't happened to them, maybe they just blow it off. And then you have this sort of subset of people in the arts or the music industry, and, you know, by nature, musicians, I think, are quite literally sort of attuned to higher vibrations. And then you have their counterparts, the muse, who by nature is sort of going through the world with an open heart and really in touch with her emotions, you know, I mean, really, like, bravely sort of embracing this, you know, intensely emotional life, you know. And if you're going to live that life, and you're cut off from your emotions, that just makes no sense. You're not going to enjoy it, for one thing, and you're not going to be very inspiring. And so I feel like it probably, that sort of, that instant recognition or that sensory recognition probably, I'm guessing, happens more often to people like us, or maybe more instantaneously, but not exclusively, just because we're just sort of in that arena where we're very attuned to those emotions and those vibrations and those, the whole idea of something mystical existing in the world, you know? I mean, if you're a songwriter and you don't have some sort of poetic view of the bigger picture of life and relationships and love, I mean, I don't know how cool your lyrics are going to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. The first step is just, you know, being open to the possibilities and being open to your surroundings and the people around you and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And I really feel like, you know, I certainly was. I mean, even from a very young age. And that's the other thing. I think, like, maybe musicians and the women who are drawn to that arena, you know, maybe we were born with a certain adventurous spirit or, you know, a craving for intense experiences.
Yes.
Because I definitely feel like I was, but I don't have any real musical ability. I mean, I'm a great dancer. That's about as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. And I played the piano because I took lessons as a kid, but I didn't really stick with it. It wasn't a big passion for me, but I definitely had an adventurous spirit. I wanted to experience all kinds of things, an intense passion and an intense love. And, you know, with that comes intense pain usually, but I mean, at some point, hopefully, less of the latter than the former, but, that might be why I ended up being drawn to, just hanging around autistic people and musicians and that kind of thing. And so, however it starts or however you end up there, yeah, I definitely think that, you know, people like Joe and people like myself were open to feeling those very subtle vibrations. And if you, like, when I think about the way we met and the way I reacted when I heard his voice 6 years before we met, you know, I mean, I'm somebody who really likes to stay open to sort of, you know, metaphysical ideas and what we used to call it New Age stuff, now they call it woo-woo stuff, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea of reincarnation is, I mean, it's really intriguing. And when I was younger, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. But when I was really young, I thought, no, that's crazy. And then I kind of went back and forth because it's, you know, it's a little bit of an out there idea. But if it exists, if it's a real thing, it would be the only kind of explanation for why I had that weird reaction when I heard his voice on the radio at 14. And I just knew not only that I knew him, but that we had been in love and I experienced this really visceral, you know, sense of heartache. Like, that was so shocking because I'd never been in love. And yet all of a sudden I knew what it felt like to lose that. And it was devastating and it was bizarre. And I thought it was crazy. And then when we met and I kind of heard that voice in my head saying, this is a man you're meant to marry. I mean, I think, I don't know what else. There's no other explanation that sounds logical to me. So, and I also feel like it might happen again in our next life just because I don't think that things really panned out in the best possible way. I mean, we had a few great years and then things just nosedived and, so who knows? You know, I think back then the term soulmate to me was like, this was pretty simple. Like, you had one great love or one soulmate, you know, and I thought, well, he's mine. And now I think about it and I think, well, you know, I think we all have a number of soulmates, you know, I think my sister is my soulmate. Mm-hmm. I think some of my friends are my soulmates that, there's that instant familiarity. I've had, friends and lovers that I've met and instantly felt like I knew them, even from across the room, not fallen in love with them. But so, and there's a term I've read recently about twin flames and how they're the one, you only have one of those and they're your perfect partner. And so if, you know, if that's a real thing, again, now we're getting pretty woo-woo, but if Joe is my twin flame, I don't think that's how you would describe that. I think that he and I had a chance for something long-term, and I think that we ended up teaching each other a good life lesson and then moving on to learn the rest of them from someone else. That's kind of how I see it.
Oh, that's incredible. I love that this path that we are already on with this. And all of last year, I did nothing but listen to woo-woo podcasts. And I am exactly where I want to be. And things are aligning and making so much sense. And it's, and you know, and I found my own kind of connection back to Creator. And it's a lot, it's not something that you can just sort of, I think, have a casual conversation at a party with, because a lot, most of the people, 98% of the people will look at you and go, I don't want to have this conversation, or I don't know what you're talking about. So it's so cool to be able to almost unashamedly, unabashedly have that open conversation about the connection to music, creation, creator.
And with someone who completely understands everything without even like having to communicate it. It's like everything, every point you began to make, I was like, yes, I completely
We're
agree.
Not in a cult. We're not evangelical, but we can still have a connection and know that these things are really happening on Earth and that there's magic.
Me and Shantae are sitting here just like nodding at each other like constantly.
Oh God, it's so refreshing. I can't tell you, because honestly, it's like you said, at a party, you know, I'm not going to bring this up because I've done it and I know what happens. Mm-hmm. They either tune out, they look at you weird, they make an excuse and backpedal and go to the bathroom or get the heck away from you. And, you know, I'm not going to try to convince anybody. So it's easier to just keep that stuff to yourself and then accidentally find someone who, just sort of like this, like, I don't even know what possessed me to kind of be more open about it right now. I just feel like, I don't know, when you turn, you know, I'm 50. At 50, you start to just say what you think more often in general. But I also, there's something about you guys, maybe I just kind of felt like you would get it. And it turns out I was right. So it's refreshing. And it's nice. It's nice to be able to say that stuff and be talking to someone who gets it, who really gets it. Yes. Thank you.
Our fairy godmother, Pamela DeBar, who wrote the book, I'm with the band Confessions of a Groupie, is 70 years old. And she's, you know, doing writing workshops all over, and she's in the process of making a book because she's really interested in talking about the connection between Mary and Jesus, and Mary is the muse. And, you know, our friend Pleasant Gaiman says that she worships at the altar of rock and roll. So I'm looking
muses
forward.
Understand. We all have that connection. We all get it.
Yeah, and you know, Miss Pamela is just, I mean, she's a national treasure to start with. I can't,
yes.
I mean, when I first read her book, I remember feeling like, it was very validating, first of all, that there was someone who could be expressing something that I was feeling in my heart and living the life and validating it in this book. And I thought, if no one else in the world understands this book but me, at least I know that I'm not crazy for having, you know, just for feeling the way I do about this type of stuff. And then with every book that she writes, more and more, she's such a wonderful voice in this way. Like, I know she's put up with all kinds of sort of, you know, negativity, but I think there's a huge, relatively large segment of the population who are just so grateful for her having this voice and saying things that a lot of us feel and a lot of experiences that we're living. And the older she gets, I think the more also she's unafraid, but she certainly is courageous, you know, at book readings and stuff, and just talking about her life with unapologetically and trying to explain it, being really patiently trying to explain it to a lot of people. You know, you see her in interviews, and sometimes I don't think the interviewer notices, but I can kind of see her just, you know, summoning patience with some of the questions or the misunderstandings. And I mean, I just look up to her so much, and I'm thrilled to know she's writing another book. She had mentioned something in one of the last ones that I read about a psychic or a clairvoyant person that she knows. And I was so happy to see that published, you know, because I think there's a lot of people who shy away from mentioning it. And that part of my book, when I first talked about being 14, the prologue, that two-page prologue, I went back and forth for, I mean, at least a year. I wrote it, and I thought, well, I'm leaving it for now. You know, I can always decide if I ever sell this book, I'll decide then, talk to my publisher, whatever. But I did think, you know, some people are going to read this and just think I'm nuts, and they're not going to read past the prologue. And I finally thought, well, this is my truth, and I'm going to put it in. And I think Miss Pamela and everything that she had written up until that point, and especially that last book that I read where she just happened to mention this amazing psychic that she knows, and very casually, she just, you know, she didn't belabor the point, but she mentioned it as this is a thing, and I believe in it, and it's real, and you don't have to, you know, whatever, and I just, that kind of gave me the courage to put my truth out there in my book as well.
I'm glad you did. I'm really glad you did. And I mean, like, I got it too. One thing that my mother and I did as, you know, a girl's day out is when I was 10 years old, 12 years old, she took me to go get her tarot cards read. We loved it.
Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, one thing talking about Miss Pamela, I just read, you know, yesterday that even to this day, people are writing on her posts, hey, didn't you blow half of Hollywood? And she patiently, you know, either like, you know, says something to that, but 170 people have already come to her rescue. So she's really had to have this sex positive view ever since she was the 60s and taking it even through into the 70s, 80s. And now she's 70. Now, one thing that we really thought refreshing and enlightening in your book is that you spoke about stripping as a way to explore your identity and the power of female sexuality, even saying that it was the mothership calling you home. Now, there are still many people who have a sex negative view of this profession. So we were wondering if you could discuss how it was empowering for you.
Yeah, thanks. It really was. And I really love being able to talk about that. For me as an individual, because this is going to be my experience, obviously it's all I have. I will say that I don't believe anything, stripping in particular, is not innately good or bad or empowering or disempowering or objectifying, or at least objectifying in an unhealthy way, because I believe that there is a way to be objectifying consensually, and that is perfectly healthy. I mean, so that's a whole other conversation. But so when I first became a stripper, I was 18 years old, and I did sort of end up getting, I was a little desperate for money. I had quit meth. I had spent all my college grants and loans on drugs, and I had quit very abruptly, and I needed to start paying those back. I needed to come up with rent, and I was sort of desperate, and I couldn't get a decent job selling, you know, waitressing or anything anywhere. I lived in a college town, and, you know, those jobs get snatched up really quickly. And so my neighbor had told me about it. He was a really sweet med student, and he's like, I'm not saying that this is, you know, a great idea or it's something I see you do. Doing, but it there's a really nice gentleman's club. I've been there down the street, and it looks safe, you know, like you could make your rent until you could get on your feet, if, you know, he suggested it. And, you know, part of me, the practical part of me thought, well, great, you know, that does sound like it would kind of help me get the rent. But the bigger part of me that was really compelled to do it was something that was very innate in me. I was a very sexual person already. I was 18 years old, and yet I had been raised as a Catholic. There's a certain amount of just, it's a lot of it is unspoken. Some of it is spoken, but this sense of sexual shame and women as sexual beings being really just sort of disparaged. I mean, if you're a sexual person as a woman, you're just a slut. That's, you know, there's no two ways about it. Like, we're supposed to be sexy, but not sexual. And all I knew is that I had very strong, that part of me right around puberty started to sort of get very strong, and I had no real guidance or outlet. All I knew is that it was, you know, I was supposed to save myself for marriage and not really think about it or talk about it otherwise. And that just wasn't happening. I mean, I sensed early on that this was a very important part of me, and I liked it, and I wanted to nurture it, and I didn't want it to be shamed out of me or twisted in some way. And I sensed that the religious environment that I grew up in and the religious schools, you know, I was surrounded by nuns. I went to church twice a week. All my teachers were nuns. Most of them, half of them were just, you know, a little crazy. And it just, it wasn't a healthy environment it didn't lend itself to having a healthy relationship with your sexuality. So, I ended up being someone who was uncomfortable being nude. I'd had sex, you know, I'd had a handful of partners by 18, certainly, but I, more than a handful probably, but, you know, I wasn't comfortable being naked in public. I, or not public, but, even in private. So So I went there partly to make money, but partly to face this fear and all of these constraints that I felt were really smothering me and ruining what could have been a much more expressive, fulfilling part of my life. And as soon as I walked in the door, I mean, my first day was a little terrifying. I still remember being on stage. It was a little traumatic, but very quickly, there was something I noticed immediately from the moment I walked in the door that shocked me. And it was that everyone was having a good time. The men, the women, everyone was laughing. Everyone was playful. There was this incredible celebratory vibe in there. And some of the women, you know, back then, the men kept their hands at their sides. There was no touching. If it happened, it was isolated incidents in the corner, you know, that somebody was very careful to get away with, not like it is now. And so I expected to walk in and see a bunch of skeezy guys and unhappy women, and I don't know what, you know, and it wasn't like that at all. And so kind of my antenna pricked up, and I thought, I've never experienced anything like this. A whole room full of people just sort of comfortable in their own skins and being playful with their bodies and their, you know, their gazes and the music. And I mean, it was just a ball. And so, you know, it took me a while to get over my inhibitions. But from day one, I knew, you know, this was going to help me get over some of the damage and the, I want to call it brainwashing, but some of that sense of shame attached to my sexuality that had happened without me being able to stop it. And that's what it did. So, you know, there is a flip side to that. Like, I did come to rely on my identity as a desirable woman who had a certain amount of power and could commodify her sexuality, you know, and use it as leverage. I mean, not to say there's anything inherently wrong with that either, but for an 18-year-old who doesn't really know all the best ways to use leverage, you know, the healthiest ways to do that, you know, I became too dependent on that sort of approval and validation for my identity. But that was my fault. You know, the club itself did not force that on me. So I think that I was very young. And I, you know, I worked my way through that. I really did. At some point, you know, I stripped for a total of 14 years, and I quit in my 40s. You know, I did it in three spurts, and my final spurt was in my late 30s, early 40s. And so I had a real good handle on who I was and how much of myself was my stripper self. You know, I mean, it didn't define me by any means. And in fact, the work took on a whole new level. I mean, there was so much there, just beyond the way that it allowed me to feel validated and excited and playful with my sexuality. There was the financial freedom. I mean, that's empowering. I mean, there's absolutely no two ways about it. My parents were broke. They couldn't afford to send me a thing, and I wanted to go back to school. So I was all of a sudden at 18 years old, 100% financially independent. And I had a savings account within a matter of months. You know, I mean, it was crazy. The positive reinforcement, I would say, also is important. I mean, I wasn't just being told, oh, you're sexy, you're beautiful, you're hot, I want you. I was being told, oh, you're interesting, you're funny, you're a delight, I would love to date you, you're the whole package. You know, I mean, you would make a great partner for somebody, you would make a great date. Like, none of this stuff, I didn't know any of this stuff about myself. I had just been, you know, beaten up by a bunch of punk rockers because I'd been hanging out with a bunch of drug addicts and drug dealers. And so my self-esteem was really low. And so that was really helpful, just being appreciated for being who I was, because I was very authentic. I mean, I would just be myself talking to the customers. And then that was the other thing. I learned so much about the male psyche in that work. And since I tend to have sort of a male perspective, you know, I'm very ambitious, just being sexual, being ambitious, being independent. These are traditionally known as male qualities. They're, you know, yin yang, I would say yang qualities, right? So, I didn't know anything about men. I didn't understand how they thought or what made them tick, but in a strip club, you talk to your customers. I mean, you know, maybe during its heyday in Vegas on the night shift, you didn't do a lot of talking. But for the most part, you know, you really did. You didn't. Sometimes on a busy night, you might just go dance here, dance there. But a lot of times you sit down and get to know the guy. And so it was the beginning of what I consider now like a lifelong PhD education in the male psyche.
Yes.
And they were fascinating to me. And that's when I realized, you know, this is, I have always since then almost always worked in some arena where I was one-on-one, helping, healing, interacting, validating the male perspective, because, you know, they have, you know, there's something that they're getting too, more than just the visual, just the, you know, titillation and arousal. I mean, there's a lot that men go to strip clubs for that is absolutely valid and necessary and a beautiful part of the male experience. And so I learned all about that, and it became a passion of mine. And that's, and you know, 32 years later, I'm still working in that arena in a very targeted way. And I credit those 14 years as a stripper with being, you know, kind of my education, a big part of it anyway.
So cool. I really love that. I grew up with brothers, so I was lucky enough to get an insight into the male psyche that way. And then I had a really good conversation with my mom today. We went out for breakfast, and it was really loud where we were, so I asked to move to the front of the restaurant. And the guy, you know, the server was just kind of like, okay. And then her bacon was like just limp, and my mom, she just can't eat bacon like that. So she's like, oh, it's okay, I'm just not gonna eat it. And I was like, no, we're gonna just ask them to put your bacon back on the grill, and you're gonna ask for it more crispy. She's like, okay. But then that was twice that we had asked for accommodations. And then later on, when we were cashing out, there was a man getting a muffin. And I know this sounds really simple, and like, what is the point of this conversation? But when the woman went to go get his muffin, he said, no, I'd like the bigger muffin. And nobody would ever bat an eye at that man for asking for the bigger muffin.
No.
But we kind of got a little bit of a when we asked to move and get our bacon crispier. But I said to my mom, no more. I don't care if I seem like a bitch, or, you know, I'm not. I said thank you when we moved in. We said thank you when they got our bacon crispier. But we have to speak up for ourselves, and we need to go after things. And as women, we're seen as pushy and cranky, and is she this? And as men, that's just a thing that men do. Nobody bats an eye if a man wants to move spots or get his bacon crispier. So yes, that look into the psyche, and I've been trying to cultivate my yang lately.
I think your analogy was perfect. I don't think it was like over simple. I mean, that's a thing, like in these tiny little ways and big ways, of course, like asking for the promotion or whatever. But when you really look at your life and your day-to-day life, it's very telling that your mom didn't want to send the bacon back. And I tell you, the percentage of men who would hesitate is very small. It's, you know, so I know exactly what you're talking about, and I love hearing this. I have to stay conscious, you know, 24/7, that I don't accidentally fall into that habit of, oh, it's easier not to, or I don't want to be perceived as, you know, pushy, blah, 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 because it's so ingrained. And I love that you've made this commitment. And I think that if these modern times are going to have a real effect on how women experience life differently from here going forward, it's in those small, those little moments, or per se, they're not little, but, you know, those day-to-day moments. And I just think that you doing that is inspiring, right? Like your mom sees you, or the woman at the next table, and then they start doing it, and then it snowballs. You know what I mean? I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, this needs to become the norm for women.
Yeah.
I also find it really fascinating, you know, you talking about your career as a stripper and how positive it was and how everyone's happy there. And it made me think about, you know, all the Hollywood films or TV shows that you see that take place in strip clubs. And like, I've never really seen what you're speaking about. Like, you've never really get that like happy, like, this is a workplace, and it's a happy workplace, and it's empowering. It's crazy that the narrative for, like, strip clubs has always sort of been almost like a negative, or people think that's that's not where women want to be. It's like where women end up or on their way to something else, as opposed to, no, like, this is my career and I'm happy in it and it's positive and my experiences are positive.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, it really feels to me offensive whenever I see yet another portrayal of that world that is, and to be fair, there are clubs and there are time periods, like, you know, I was dancing during the recession in 2008 and I saw the changes, and there are, you know, so there are periods of time dependent on the economy or what club you're in or what type of club you're in or whatever, where, you know, some of those portrayals aren't too far off the mark, but it's a mix. It is one shade or of something that's much bigger, and especially in the 80s, and again also in Vegas in the 90s, not only was there that celebratory side where everyone was having fun, but it was, at least where I was working, the primary experience. I mean, it was, you know, 80% of my time there was not only fun, upbeat, and positive, but some of the best times of my life took place, you know, at Sugar's between 18 and 23 in those first 5 years. We were a family. It was fun. And it's really a shame. I don't know if it's like because it's male. You know, there's something about this, the woman in trouble and needing saving, and, you know, it's definitely more dramatic, I guess, to show that side. And there's a puritanical streak, certainly in this country, that even if someone tried to put out a movie where the strip club was neutral or a positive or partly positive experience, some producer would be like, oh, we can't put that out. You know, the we get too much backlash. You know, we have to. And, I remember just very recently I was talking to a producer friend of mine, and I was telling him about the script that I wrote, and it never went anywhere. It did well in the contest, and he asked me about it, and I said, yeah, and then it ends when I start work as a stripper. It's based on a year of my life, and it actually ends at age 18 when I get the job stripping, and that's like the sort of redemptive moment. You know, like, I had this horrible spiral with meth and the punk scene, and then I quit, and I end up stripping, and that was like the big finish. And he had to do a double take. He was like, what did you just say? You ended a script with the heroine becoming the main character becoming a stripper? Like, who does that? He was gobsmacked, and he thought it was brilliant. And he's like, that's, you know, I can see, he didn't say this, but I got the sense he was like, well, I can see why no one bought that, because the world wasn't ready for that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that to me, and here's the thing about that, stripping saved me at 18. I was dead broke. I was bankrupt emotionally, self-esteem wise, financially. I was in dire straits, and it saved me overnight. It saved me, and it did it again when Joe and I broke up, and I was heavily in debt. I was a severe drug addict or alcoholic at the time. I'd mostly given up drugs, and I had one skill, and I could pull myself together and within 24 hours have money in the bank and money to pay my credit cards and money to keep a roof over my head. And when I was 39 and I had been in real estate for 7 years at the time, and I had a lot of ups and downs, you know, some huge windfalls and some terrible dry spells, because that's real estate. I was experiencing a 6 month dry spell when gas was four something a gallon, and I was showing property all over the lake area to people who never were buying anything. So I was going broke. I was spending $50 on gas every weekend and not selling a thing. I didn't know, all of a sudden at 39, I didn't know how to pay I didn't know where next month rent was coming from. Things were bad. And, you know, I've been sober for 10 years by then, or close to it. And I thought, I can't believe this, but I'm going to have to go back to stripping just to cover next month's rent. And, I mean, I was a grown woman. I was an adult. I thought, you do what you have to do. I can do this. I'll do it till I can sell a house, whatever. The day I went back to stripping at 39, within a matter of hours, 2 hours, I realized, where have I been? This is home. Not only did I have cash in hand, you know what it's like to try to sell houses 7 days a week, for ungrateful clients who don't pay you a dime but will happily eat up all your gas, and then you walk into a strip club and somebody gives you $20 for 3.5 minutes of your time and energy, it feels really validating. And anyone who tells me that stripping is objectifying has never been a realtor, because I was far more exploited as a realtor on a daily basis than I ever was as a stripper, and that's the truth.
Amen. That's so cool. I do have a friend who was working just a regular job, and being exploited at a regular job by whatever every day. And then she did some cam work, and then she herself was working at a cocktail, a gentleman's club, and then cash, bills paid, couple of hours of work done. Yeah. But all of a sudden there's a problem with it, and she gets shamed because now she's using her body and her stuff to exploit. It's just the double standard is insane, but I totally understand, and I've seen how it can be empowering. So thank you for sharing that. And I think it's going to be really enlightening for people to hear that as well.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me a platform to say that. That's something I've wanted to say out loud. For a very long time.
So speaking of, we were talking about men a little bit. You went from Brad in high school, regular Brad, to suddenly being with Joe Walsh, and at such a very young age. Throughout the book, there's so many talented musicians and actors who entered your world. Also, I remember a part in your book saying that, chaos and all of that was okay. It was boredom that you didn't like. So how surreal was that for you in your early 20s? Were you ever starstruck? And are there any specific or special memories of meeting certain actors or musicians that you'd like to share with us?
I mean, it's funny because coming from the punk scene like I had, there was sort of this sense that there was no sort of VIP or backstage area. In the punk scene, it was very egalitarian, there was no backstage, and you go to see a Black Flag show or GBH or some local, in Austin, the Offenders, and the guys in the band are hanging out with out on the floor, they're not hiding out backstage. So I always had this sort of, I didn't ever have this sort of pedestal, put the guys on the pedestal attitude. And yet at the same time, every now and then I would just find myself doing that double take. Okay, when I met Ringo Starr, what I had been thinking all day when Joseph were going to go meet Ringo was, oh, how fun. I get to meet a Beatle, and look how excited Joe is. Clearly he has such a strong affection for this man. I mean, I don't think they were super good friends back then, but they really had a really sort of nice bond, and Joe looked up to him, and I could see how excited he was to introduce us. And so that was half the fun of it for me. Plus I was like, oh, for the rest of my life, I can say I met a Beatle. That's kind of cool. And then he enters the room, and honestly, it just hit me right then. And I don't know if it's an energy field he has around him, because he's really personable, but it just hit me. Wow. That's Ringo Starr. And then he comes up to me and kisses. Yeah. And he comes up to me and he kisses just as natural as can be, the both sides of my face. And he laughs it off I'm from France. And I was just sort of speechless. And I was completely caught off guard by my speechless. I thought I was going to be it's a cool, nothing gets to me, punk rock chick. But no, it did affect me. And I think the whole tour, but less because he was a Beatle and more because he really does have this amazing energy, and it's very inclusive and it's very loving. He has a very loving vibe to him. And I think I just maybe I picked up on that. There were other times, I remember Joe was really excited one day. He was going to get a call from Quincy Jones. And at the time I didn't really know who Quincy Jones was or how powerful he was or how revered. And I had a vague idea of who he was in the music business. And I forget why he was calling Joe, but Joe had been waiting all day for this call, and I happened to be closest to the phone, and it rang, and so I got nervous picking it up and just saying yes, I'll go get him, and I was starstruck, just sort of based off of Joe's, because it was rare that he was ever intimidated or starstruck. But I remember with Quincy Jones, he kind of had that. I think, and for some reason, Lionel Richie, but just, you know, I love the Commodores, and I just, there's something, and I didn't quite realize until Joe dragged me over and introduced us all of a sudden, and I realized it was shaking his hand, and it just kind of hit me all of a sudden, like, you know, there's something, I don't care how big you are, like, I mean, like, Tom Petty is huge, right, and, Pete Townsend, who is lovely, but I was not someone who would spend night after night listening to their records over and over and over again, you know, so it was, but with Lionel Richie, I was like, that kind of stuff that he had done, his career was huge to me, you know, anything sort of soul music, funk music, you know, that was always my thing, much more than like rock music, so I could meet the biggest rock stars in the world and not be too starstruck. Except the Beatles were huge to me. Like Sgt. Pepper was like life changing for me. So those were some of the more isolated incidents, I would say. The funner ones, I mean, funny enough, like Stevie Nicks, you know, I have a whole story about her because I grew up on MTV. You know, I was like 14, 15 or whatever in high school. I forget when it started, but those formative years where you not only have access to radio and records, which I couldn't really afford, but MTV was showing you, you know, not just pictures of these musicians, but the way they were dressing and the way they moved and danced. And you got to, and like even the DJ, the MTV VJ, I guess you call him, like Nina Blackwood. Like I was kind of a fan of Nina Blackwood. And then I got to meet her and it was actually kind of a weird meeting. I found out much later that, you know, she and Joe were good friends. And I think she was just worried about, how badly he was partying. But so she never did stay at our house long, but she was someone I had kind of like modeled myself after to some degree at 14. And here I was meeting her and Stevie Nicks and I, so those were two of the funner ones. I didn't get to meet as many women as I would have liked to. I would have liked to have met Chrissy Hynde. She was a good friend of Joe's, you know, some others. But Dave Edmunds, that was huge to me because I used to strip for years. I had been stripping to his song, and I'd always thought, you know, this guitar sound is the sexiest thing in the world. And then I recognized it at a rehearsal, and I was like, I know that sound. And I look up and it's Dave Edmunds, and then he and his wife become, you know, two of our best friends. So that was, I have to say, Dave Edmunds and his wife Cece, also Levon Helm, because for some reason we just had a crazy instant bond, and I don't even know what that was about to this day, but that we just did, and I adored him, and also his, you know, I was a huge fan of the band, and Skunk Baxter as well. Doobie Brothers and Steely Dan are two of my, you know, as far as rock music, those were a couple of my favorites.
And oh yeah, us Skunk too. And our family is huge, and yeah, in love with them.
Right? Like, I mean, the fact that he was in those two bands alone sort of makes him iconic to me, and yet, you know, he and I had a really lovely friendship, and I think that Skunk, of all people, in that whole book, in that whole period of my life, I think he probably saw what was happening and how overwhelmed I was and how probably potentially vulnerable I was to the drugs and the lifestyle. I mean, he didn't interfere, I wasn't starstruck around him or anything, but it was, for me, it was very special to have him around. I really adored him. I loved our friendship. And so the whole thing was, you know, it was almost like I had this fairy tale that just came with all this other amazing stuff. I mean, it really, I would have been happy to just be in love with Joe if he were, you know, a fry cook, probably. Mm-hmm. you know, but his lifestyle was really fun, and I got to meet, you know, dozens of amazing people.
So many cool people.
It was inspiring.
Yeah. And speaking of some women that you did actually get to meet, you met both Ringo's wives, first Maureen and then Barbara. Would you talk a little bit about them?
Yeah, they were great. And to use the word inspiring yet again, one of the things that I loved and am so grateful for in regard to meeting them was that I sort of would silently watch them and how they embodied this role. I mean, I don't think I was very good at emulating it at all. I would have liked more exposure to it, but you know, they were different, but they were true rock star wives, right? I mean, they were kind of as elevated in that way as you could get. And while Barbara was sort of, she had this very calm presence. She was somewhat, I want to say, demure. I mean, she's very, very down to earth and friendly, and in that she had this calm presence. She wasn't, you know, she didn't dress wild and gypsy-like. And then you have Maureen, who had this very sort of, I mean, just the vibe around Maureen was very sort of colorful and reminiscent of the 60s. Or, you know, like, she just had this, she exuded a certain sexy femininity and a strength at the same time. I mean, I could have followed Maureen around probably just like a fly in the wall for a year and just watched her every move because I really admired her. I mean, she was very feminine, and at the same time, she was married to someone who, you know, who was a very strong personality. Her husband, Isaac Tigret, who started the Hard Rock, you know, she was Ringo's wife, and then she was Isaac's wife. And to watch her with Isaac, who was a very strong, independent man, and to watch the way he just sort of would, you know, follow her around, or at least, you know, when she came to retrieve him from our room one night, the way she, all she had to do was just walk in the room, and he just was like, he was up, he was out the door with her. And I thought, you know, I don't know how she just did that, but I want to learn how to do that with Joe. And I never did, but it was a glimpse into, I think, an being a partner of someone who's really famous or really powerful, or, you know, the guy who started the Hard Rock Cafes. He had a certain, I mean, he had a presence. He owned every room he walked into, and yet when Maureen walked in, then she owned it. It was the dynamic was something that I could only strive for, to be in a relationship. It was everything that was wrong with my relationship with Joe, which was that I didn't know how to be strong in my own self in a relationship with him. It was, you know, he had all the clout and the experience and the presence and the, you know, that magneticism. And I became his shadow. Whereas Maureen was with an equally strong man, and so was Barb. And yet they were both very captivating on their own. And they were in an equal partnership. You know, Ringo was not leading Barbara around by the nose, and neither was Isaac. It was, if anything, I think, probably the other way around, you know, or at least, you know, perfectly balanced. Does that make sense? You know,
Totally.
They were really fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why we are so fascinated about these women and wanting to read their books, tell their stories, and now so lucky to be able to be having these conversations in, you know, with these people like you. You know, it's unfair that these women have been reduced to just a wife or just a girlfriend. And it's like, hey, smarten up. They're so much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I don't think Barbara's ever going to write a book. I sure do wish Maureen had. I mean, I think I've read snippets from other books, like maybe Joe Wood or I forget who, but I would love to know more about her life. I'd like a whole book on her life. And because this is about female empowerment. And in this day and age, we have to start going there, and we need inspiration. We need role models. And sure, there are women, like I was one of them, who lost themselves completely next to their powerful partner. And there are civilian women, you know, in the general public, there are women doing that. And then there are strong women who have somehow figured out how not to do that. Now I have at this point, but it took me, you know, 30 odd years to get to that point. And, we need to, It can be done, you know, it can be, I don't know why the world doesn't see that, or why would anyone think that someone like Ringo would want to be with a doormat, first of all?
Exactly.
Joe didn't enjoy being with me. The more I lost myself, the less he wanted to be with me. The reason he was attracted to me in the first place was because I was a fairly strong, independent 18-year-old. You know, I immediately started losing it, but that was the part of me that he was attracted to, and that's what most of those guys really want in their life. Mm-hmm. You know, they want a strong woman, and as soon as they become a doormat or drug addict, you know, that the writing is on the wall. That relationship's going to end.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I hope that, you know, Barbara would write a book, and it's a shame that we don't have something of Maureen in her own words, but we are happy that you've written a book. You know, you've toured with Joe, you've lived with him, and we really encourage people to go and read the book or listen to the audiobook, because it's so rich. There's so much in there. You know, you talk about shows that you've been to and tours that you've been on and the special camaraderie that grows when you're on tour with the same crew. You talk about hanging out with Stevie Nicks and inheriting some of her wardrobe. When did you decide that you wanted to share your story, and what was the writing process for like for you?
Well, you know, I think that for most of the time since the breakup, which the first breakup was in 93, and then the last final second breakup was 95. So for most of that time, which is, you know, 25 years, I think I felt like I have this good story, but I'm not comfortable sharing it. There are a lot of reasons not to share it. I'll revisit that idea a couple years from now, and then I would think, you know, I have other stories to tell. This one, there's so many complications with this. First of all, my story is very intricately entwined with someone else, and it really took me a good 15, 20 years to get all the clarity I needed to even think I could write the book well. And so one day, I had been writing another book. I'd been writing this other book about the 1 year of my life that I had left home and started college and gotten into meth and then started stripping. And it wasn't very good. I wasn't as good of a writer then, and so it never did get published. But that was the book I'd kind of been writing off and on for 10 years or so. And then in 2013, I was actually I had a couple of weeks sort of stuck at home. I was recovering from surgery, and I was watching a bunch of movies. And I saw this little indie film with Michelle Williams, and I couldn't tell you what it's called right now, but she plays the wife of, I forget the name of the actor even.
Blue Valentine?
No.
Oh, no, the one with Seth Rogen. I know what you're
yes,
talking about.
Yes, that's the one, yes.
This Waltz or yep. something? Yeah.
Yes, 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 that's it. Something Waltz, yeah. So there's this aspect to that movie where she, you know, she's sort of sexually unfulfilled. Like, she loves her husband. She's not, but they're a little incompatible that way, you know, and she loves him. So she just tries to, you know, you can kind of see her telling herself, oh, just get over it. You know, you're trying to get him to be more aggressive. He's not going for it. Just, you know, and you could see they had this great love, but she was becoming more and more frustrated. And that aspect of my story, that owning your sexuality, your authentic sexuality, being unapologetic for it and getting those needs met, and the conflict that women have, you know, being nurturers or being partners and not being able to speak up or being stifled or censored when they do try to speak up. You know, it's a real thing. I'm not the only one out there who went through that. And so I had, not only is recovery, you know, my years of addiction and my years in recovery are the most potent influences on who I am today. And the depths of my addiction were in a relationship that affected me to a degree that all my relationships since then were affected, most of them negatively, because I was so afraid of losing myself again that it took me a very long time to be able to even be in a healthy relationship. I would do a lot of, you know, come here, go away, come here, go away. You know, I had a sort of my attachment style was like a ping pong match or something. So I knew that I wanted to write about addiction and recovery because I felt like that, you know, we need more voices, you know, we need to talk more about the core causes. I wanted to infuse the story with some of my childhood experiences and then the experiences of living with Joe and my addiction, my pattern of addiction then, just as one story sort of illuminating how some people from a middle-class background, you know, a quote-unquote normal background become addicts. So I always had that story, and I had written some short stories around that. And in fact, the Joshua Tree story from the book, I wrote that as a short story, and that was actually one of the first ones I ever had published in this great lit magazine called The Foliate Oak. But I did not think I was going to write the book. And then when I saw that movie, it just affected me so much that all of a sudden I thought, this is not an aspect of a woman's experience that gets any attention. I was so shocked and so happy to see it addressed in that movie. I was overcome with this just this knowingness that it was time to write my story, not just because I'm passionate about addiction and recovery and getting, you know, starting that conversation or adding to that public conversation, but I could infuse it with the story of female sexuality, which is, you know, my bigger passion probably. And that's when I knew not only that I should, but that I kind of, you know, I almost felt obligated at that point. I felt like as a writer and a memoirist, for me to not write this story now that I even have an, yet another important angle to include. So I decided in, yeah, the spring of maybe January or so of 2013, and I started writing it later that year. And, you know, I was really busy with work at the time. I was traveling a lot. And so for the first 9 months, I wrote every day off I had, I would sit down for 5 to 8 hours and write. It was sporadic, so I didn't get too far. And then business slowed down, and so I just buckled down and started writing full-time for the next 9 months. So for 18 months, I spent writing the rough draft. And then I put it aside, and I had some other issues. The surgery that I'd had turned out to be botched so badly that I had to have a couple more surgeries. So the next couple of years were sort of a bit of a whirlwind of trying to get my breathing back because my nose was collapsing, going through a lot of surgeries, a lot of stress, spending all my life savings, and trying to polish the book. And I had an agent, and he sold it in October of 2016. And by then, I had just started a new business as an intimacy coach and surrogate partner. And I was slowly learning the business over about 6 months or so. And the same month I sold the book, I had my final surgery. My nose was rebuilt. I could breathe again. I had a book deal, and my business exploded all within like 3 weeks of each other. And that was like 2 years ago. Yeah. And then the book came out in March. And my only complaint, honestly, is that everything in my life is kind of going so well, I don't have enough time to dedicate to any one area. I would love to be doing more like book readings and, you know, like a book tour and more interviews and stuff. And I would love to be, I would love to see every client that calls me, but I'm just divvying up my time. And it's been an amazing experience, to be honest. When the book came out, I really was unprepared. I wrote the book as a passion project. I don't know if I ever really thought it would get, even though I was under contract for a long time, when it came out, it just sort of hit me like, oh my gosh, I've done it. Like
Wow.
And I've been getting a lot of really positive feedback because I didn't really know what to expect. So I'd like to also find time to write my next one, which is going to be more about, what I went through in the 10 years after I got sober and the intimacy issues that I struggled with and how to start having relationships and dating and all that. But, you know, my process is basically to spend every waking moment that I'm not trying to, you know, work and keep a roof over my head, just at my desk writing, because I'm not a fast writer. It took me 4 years to get this one right.
So, wow. That is that insight into how long it takes and how to divide your time, because I feel like I can relate to you in the sense that you have a job where you are dealing with people, interacting with people, helping, healing, nurturing, but then you also have your own creative side of yourself where you like to write and create and be a creative person. And sometimes you're like, well, and it's a passion thing that has turned into a job as well. We can kind of relate with the podcast, a passion project that's turned into a job while still having another job. And it's like, well, I really want to put my energy here. And then you kind of realize that, you know, I know there's just like people that go, oh, like, I'm so busy all the time. And you're like, buddy, you don't know busy.
Yeah. And then I kind of feel like a jerk complaining about it because, you know, there were years in my life where nothing was going right. And I actually had something to complain about. Now my biggest complaint is that everything is going right and it's more than I can handle.
Yep. So, totally hear you.
It's really like, I don't think that a lot of people, maybe certainly from, I'm not exactly sure how old you guys are, but I know that you're a younger generation than me, and the generation older than me, they're just not used to women taking on so much. So it's almost like not even my own parents really kind of grasp how busy I am, that I've, you know, that it's 24/7. I feel like I'm, like if I were a guy, maybe maybe I just got my medical degree and I'm working as an intern around the clock in a hospital, nobody would expect me to you know, have time to chat or go for coffee, they'd be like, oh, he's like, you know, so ambitious and he's juggling all this stuff and his, you know, school and his work and his whatever. But with women, I don't think, unfortunately, in this day and age still, I don't think people really quite grasp how, you know, you've got the day job and the creative thing. And, you know, I don't know how anyone with children does it, first of all. Like, I don't even have a pet right now, and I feel like I can't,
same.
I can't keep up with everything. And I just don't, I don't know, do you guys feel like the people in your life understand how much you're taking on and how busy you are?
Well, we understand. Yeah. The two of us understand.
No, you
I
have
think
each other.
My partner understands because he's watching that I'm, you know, get home from working 8 hours at one job and then I'm eating standing up to about to go and rush off. And in the meantime, too, I am very involved in, you know, my yoga community and my self-care routines and things like that. So I'm making sure that I'm taking time to rest and meditate and exercise and things like that. And so I don't know how it seems that in a way that I've been able to just find more minutes in a day to get things done, but it's definitely a shift in perspective. And people close to me realize, I think, what it takes. And
yeah. The ones that witness it.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And I applaud you for doing the self-care, because for me, that's always been the first thing to go, right? Like, I used to have 5 workouts a week, but now I have 3, and now I have 2, and now I have 1. And then, you know, that 20 minutes or 40 minutes that I like to stretch and do yoga and meditate in the morning, you know, now that's, you know, 30 minutes, that's 15 minutes, that's 10 minutes, that's 3 stretches in the hallway as I'm, you know, going out the door just to, and then I get mad at everyone else, and I think, well, I'm the one who did that. I'm the one who decided, you know, being there for someone else is more important than my 30-minute morning routine or my third workout of the week. So it's just like ordering the, you know, sending back your bacon. You know, it's like I have to remind myself I'm the only one who's going to set those boundaries.
Exactly. And I have to make sure that I'm not being resentful of my partner who works 4 days a week and has Thirsty Thursday at work and tells me that, oh, we just opened up the beers at work. And I have to make sure I don't go, well, that's so nice for you. You know what I mean? Like, because I'm the one that decided to do all of these things. So, you know, and yep. He's relaxed and happy and he's not running around all the time. And that's good for him and that's good for me. So I just need to keep that perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point. I should remember that because I've been there too.
You said in your book that in Joe, you discovered one of your discarded parts. Now, we loved the way that you used language like that. And it was very clear that you've studied and analyzed people. Two questions here, kind of in one, is I'm very curious because you said that Joe was always a supporter of your writing. Did he support you in sharing this story? And then this analyzing of people in this sense, is this that part of why you decided to go into therapy and start on that journey?
To the second question, I will first say yes, it's absolutely a part of it. You know, but I'll address the first question. You know, Joe was very supportive of my writing, and I always like the chance to state that outright. His lifestyle was such that it wasn't, in some ways, it probably was very conducive to me writing, except, or at least getting started, because I didn't have to work once I moved in with him, except for our lives really did revolve around his work and his needs and his friends. You know, but I had the opportunity to sit down and write and to say, you know, I'm going to not join you guys downstairs in the playroom and I'm going to be in the office all night writing. He never tried to pull me away, and he bought me this amazing typewriter, and he encouraged me in many ways, you know, to further any of my creative passions. And I really just wanted to go downstairs and do coke with everybody else. And so he was very supportive, and the lifestyle was just too compelling for me, and the strength that or lack thereof that I had, the inner strength that I had, and the commitment to my writing. Like, had I been maybe a little bit further along, I probably would have made more of a commitment. But, you know, even if I had sat down to write back then, the coke just really hijacks your brain in such a way that the creative flow, which for me is something, it's like a constant. I mean, I need solitude every day to let my mind wander and get into that flow. I can sit down sometimes for 5 hours and it will kick in. But back then it was a little less accessible, and the more coke I did, the less access I had to that state of flow, because I couldn't be present. I was constantly like, what can I do next? What can I, you know, what fun can I do next? What can we talk about next? What record can we play next? You know, it was just never in the moment. It was never able to just tap into any sort of higher realm or imaginative, you know, inspirational sort of thread. And I certainly didn't want to look at any deeper themes in life, because then I might have to face, you know, the wreckage that my life was becoming. And so as a writer, if I don't have some sort of deeper theme, there's really no point in me writing. That's just the kind of writer I am. And I didn't want to look at deeper themes back then because I was, you know, shattering all sense of responsibility and any sort of healthy theme there could be for my life. So as far as writing the book, I had tried to reach out to him actually when I decided to write it in 2013, and we hadn't talked for a couple of years. I don't know if his email changed. I heard through the grapevine, because I still know some people who said that all of a sudden he did become hard to reach. Like, a lot of people were not able to reach him all of a sudden. And I don't know, maybe he was really busy touring or whatever. But I had put out some calls and emails and not gotten anything back. And then I just started focusing on the book. And I thought, well, I'll probably reach out to him again, which I did. I forget exactly when. It might have been the year I got the book deal, I think, or maybe right afterwards. And I couldn't reach him. And I did reach his road manager. I left a message with him, but I never heard anything. And now that I look back, I think, well, I haven't heard anything since, and I don't really expect to. I don't know how he feels about it. I can guess. But honestly, he has a right to whatever he feels. Mm. And my only hope is that at the very least he found some of it enjoyable. Like, maybe he enjoyed going down memory lane a little bit. I understand that it's difficult when somebody reveals anything about your past or your private life, and it was, you know, clearly in service to my greater themes, in service to my story, which was impossible to pull apart from his. But I do also like to think that, you know, so much time has gone by, and then, you know, he's so established as a beloved rock star that I also knew that nothing I wrote was going to have any sort of negative effect on him, his career or anything like that. So, you know, I haven't heard anything, and I don't expect I will.
That's such a good way to think about it, though. You know, he has a right to feel however he does feel about it. And this is your experience, too. It's not just his experience. So people who may have a problem, or, you know, with women writing their own memoirs about the time that they've spent with the rock star, who may think it's exploitative, or that they're doing it for reasons that aren't about the healing of the person writing the book, then, you know, they can just frig off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a certain aspect to, you know, a rock star's life and their relationships that it's integral to that relationship. Like, I came second to Joe's music. I always knew that, and I was fine with it. To this day, I'm fine with it. His music was a huge thing. It was a gift to the world. He was meant to do that, you know. And I was the next thing of importance in his life. But when he got sober and when we broke up, I think that there was an aspect to the sort of abrupt way that it happened, or at least a certain there was a sense of abandonment. I mean, he actually let it drag on longer than it normally would have, because he, I think, didn't want to hurt me by breaking up with me long before or long after it was time. But there were people in his life who didn't want him to associate with me, and I think that's one of the reasons he didn't try to help me more when I was really spiraling. I can't say that for sure, but it's definitely the sense that I got that he, you know, his handlers didn't want his new reputation as the newly sober eagle to be too marred. And, you know, and I was a mess. And so there's some validity to that. But at the same time, he was the only person I knew who was sober, and I was asking him for help. And he kept refusing to tell me about AA or take me to a meeting. And so, you know, nothing made me happier than the fact that he got his career back and that he has just soared, you know, since then. I mean, it's a comeback story of the century, really. It's a beautiful thing, and he deserved every bit of it. But if it weren't for his rock stardom, I have to believe that he might have helped me get into a rehab or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, he might have taken me to a meeting, he might have. And so when I wrote this book, I thought, you know, I managed to make it, I found people to help me, but I kind of had a right to tell my story publicly because there was an aspect to his life that was very public that did affect me. Mm-hmm. Negatively. And mm-hmm. this almost in a way sort of balanced that out, you know?
Yes.
And I have to believe that he's, you know, he's a very fair person. He's a very fair-minded person. I'm sure that he understands why I wrote it. And he probably understands that his lifestyle, which was out of his control to some degree, was damaging for someone who was so young and vulnerable as me. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I kind of hope that to me, it does sort of make a space for this book to come out without any, hopefully any complaints or any hard feelings.
Absolutely. And speaking about, you know, your complicated, the complicated nature of your relationship with Joe, and you were talking earlier about, you know, your experiences in your stripping career. It really feels like all of your experiences have kind of led up to you becoming an intimacy coach and this incredible career that you have now. Do you feel like you've just had a whole life of, you know, leading you there? Was this fate? And we would just love for you to talk about being an intimacy coach and what that entails and, you know, what it means to you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I love talking about my work. And it's so great that I sort of stumbled on this career option in the first place. And I think it was probably 2015, maybe 2014. At one point, I was thinking about, you know, I really need to find something more fulfilling. And I had always considered becoming a sex therapist, but I had not gone back to college. You know, once I got sober, I kind of got into real estate right away. And from there, I told you, I went into stripping. And so, you know, the idea of going back to college was always really appealing to me, but just the timing wasn't right. I either didn't have the money or the time, or I don't know. So around 2014 or 15, I was thinking about this again. This was probably in between polishing the manuscript draft number 6 or 7, I don't know. And so I was just online and scrolling through different colleges, and, you know, because getting a degree in psychology or marriage and family counseling is one thing, but I very specifically was interested in sex therapy. And there's not a lot of colleges that actually focus on that. There's a few of them. And somewhere along the line, I went down the rabbit hole and I started following links, and I ended up on an intimacy coaching website. And I thought, well, what in the world is this? This is fascinating. You know, this is kind of right up my alley. My whole life since getting sober has been about trying to heal the walls that went up, you know, trying to heal the wounds and drop the walls that went up in that painful breakup with Joe. And it was because I had become so vulnerable that I put up those walls. Everyone I was attracted to tended to be someone with I tend to like men with strong personalities, and I loved being in love. So I knew that I had a habit of allowing the relationship to sweep me away, and I would drop all my goals. And so all through my 30s, as I got sober at 29, and all through my 30s, you know, I was very hesitant to date. And when I did, I wouldn't let anyone get too close. And I dated a lot of guys who lived out of state, or I had a lot of like flings, 2 weeks here, a weekend there, or whatever. But I was very, very lonely. I mean, I was desperate for genuine intimacy, but I was absolutely incapable of it. You know, I didn't love myself enough yet. I wasn't able to be my authentic self. I wasn't able to be, to let anyone see any side of me that I thought was less than really attractive. Like, you know, sometimes I can be really crabby, and especially back then, because I'd never slept, I was overworked, and I hadn't yet to really get a handle on all those emotions that I had been, the anger that I've been stuffing all my life. You know, early sobriety, even for me, like it was a good 5-6 years before I was able to really express my anger or fear or frustration in healthy ways. And so I didn't want to date anyone or let anyone get too close, because they'd see that side of me being scared or frustrated or crying or depressed, because I was dealing with a lot of depression. And I just thought, nobody's going to see how depressed I am and really love me or want to be with me. So I continued to have, I dated. I kept putting myself out there little by little, and I was getting therapy. I had a wonderful talk therapist. But there were, you know, there was no intimacy coach around when I was in my 30s for me to hire to help me kind of speed up that process. What I had to do, because the best way to heal your intimacy issues is to go out there and experience intimacy. And so what I had to do was experience it in little increments by dating a little here, dating a little there, and trying each time to be my most authentic self, to let the guy get to know me just a little bit better, let him see me maybe not at my worst, but not at my best. And it was a slow, long process. And at 39, exactly 10 years from like 9 years and 10 months or something from the day I got sober, I fell in love and had an amazing relationship with this guy for about a year. And it was very healing, because he saw, he really got to know me. He saw every side of me, all my best sides, all my worst sides. He saw me scared. He saw me angry. He saw me depressed. He saw me, you know, all my good qualities. And he loved me 100% the same for all of it. You know, like, it was a really healing experience. And I learned how to fight for my writing time, because God love him, he did try to interfere with that. And so I was learning how to set boundaries in a relationship, how to be myself, how to allow intimacy and explore that and enjoy it and accept him for his imperfect, you know, sides as well. It was a big adventure. But it took me 10 years to get there. So not too long after that, you know, I was sort of exploring a different work in that arena, but it was again in like 2015 or so that I stumbled on this intimacy coaching site, and then also the surrogate partner training that I got, because surrogate partner work and intimacy coaching have a lot of overlap. And so I applied for the training with the International Professional Surrogates Association, which is this amazing organization that sort of stems from directly from Masters and Johnson and the work that they were doing with not just in emotional intimacy, but the way it manifests physically, you know, sexual dysfunctions or dissociation or a touch aversion. There are a lot of ways that a fear of intimacy can manifest in a person that makes it impossible for them to date or have a relationship or experience any sort of emotional or physical or sexual intimacy. And so with my fascination and passion for healthy sexuality and sexual expression, my background working with men as a stripper and in other areas, and this new field of intimacy coaching, I just jumped in with both feet, you know, and then of course my personal experience. I just thought, everything I've ever done, you know, I never knew where my experience, where I was going to be able to apply it. Where do you go from stripping? I mean, you can become a salesperson because it does teach you amazing sales skills, but I hate sales. Unless I'm selling lap dances, honest to God, I hate every form of sales there is. It's just, so I didn't know what I was going to do. I had a lot of very specialized skills, and I didn't know where to use them. And then all of a sudden I stumbled on this, and I was like, oh, this is my calling. This is exactly where I'm meant to be. So it took a while to get the training, because they're very selective about who they, you know, allow to do it. And then I did that in 2016, immediately got a built a website for intimacy coaching. I didn't need certification to be an intimacy coach, but for surrogate partnership to be supervised and certified by IPSA, I did. It was very intensive training. And so I've been interning for them for 2 years and doing that work. And those clients are dealing with intimacy issues, and they have they need to go at a slower pace. They, some of them have a lot of trauma in their past. And then my intimacy coaching clients are men, anyone from guys who need help learning how to be comfortable with a woman, initiate a move, you know, or just ascertain whether she's interested, go on a date, everything from those early activities to how do I go in for a kiss? How do I... how do I make out with someone or develop any sort of touch, you know, intimate type of touch without being completely nervous and anxious? And, you know, a lot of these guys had a bad experience or two, or they're just extremely shy, or maybe they had some bullying, or maybe they just went through a really difficult divorce and they have no mojo. Their confidence is shot. I get clients all across the board, all different ages, from in their 20s to in their 60s, guys with no experience. They've had this issue all their life. They've never been on a good date. Other guys who had all kinds of mojo, and then they had a horrible divorce, and now their confidence is shattered, and they finally go on a date, and all of a sudden they're, you know, they're not sexually functioning in the way they used to. And it's a lot of times one of the most primary reasons they're coming to me is because they have some level of performance anxiety, and they're not being in the moment, or maybe they've been with someone for so long and they're so focused on being a good partner, a good lover, getting her needs met, that they've lost touch with their own. And if you get a little older sometimes, you need to be able to focus on not just her body, but your own body. So most of what I do is about mindfulness, helping my clients, first of all, get in the moment, stay in the moment, find a place of relaxation. I create a safe space in session where they get to know me. We spend a lot of time getting to know each other. And so they recognize me as a trust, someone who's not going to reject them, not going to laugh at them, not going to make them feel embarrassed or uncomfortable or awkward or ashamed. You know, it's a very open, loving, receptive, safe space for them to communicate their needs, to get in touch with their needs, to have certain experiences, learning how to touch and be touched.
That's the surrogate partnership piece, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
The surrogate partnership is, you know, there's a set of core exercises that we do. And, you know, the surrogate partner, by design, if it's in the client's best interest, you know, the mindfulness, communication, and touching exercises will gradually escalate into a sexual arena if that's in the client's best interest. The sexual contact is actually a small percentage of the overall work, you know, because you're doing a number of sessions, 3 to 6 months sometimes, or more. As an intimacy coach, I use some of those exercises. You know, sometimes one of the most common exercises I do is one of the first ones. It's just touching each other's hand and forearm, and for a long period, and just learning how to stay in the moment as opposed to that spectating voice in your head when you're nervous. Am I touching her right? Is she enjoying this? Is it too fast? Is it too slow? Instead, just being present, letting me touch your arm and your hand, and then you take a turn, touch my arm and the hand. So some of these exercises are almost rudimentary seeming, but by and large, if somebody's experiencing performance anxiety, it's because they've lost touch with that instinctual part of themselves that just loves, enjoys, and feels pleasure in touching someone else, having someone else touch them, the nerve-ending stimulation, you know. So it's a lot about, you know, sort of retraining the brain, you know, rebuilding or building new neural pathways from the ones that say, oh, when I touch my partner, I get anxious. I don't know if I'm doing it right, or I feel rejected, or my sexual functioning doesn't kick in, or it kicks in too fast. okay, so that's where their neural pathway is taking them, and they come into session with me, and after one or three or six sessions, you know, just touching my arm, they start to retrain the brain to stay in that sense of touch and just, you know, stop feeling anxiety about the future or what I'm thinking and feeling, and just stay in that that sense of physical pleasure and that sense of intimate contact. You know, there's everything from eye gazing to communicating desires or secret fantasies that you might not have ever said out loud, because, you know, a lot of my clients grew up with sexual shame. Some of my clients, most of what we do is communication exercises. They just need someone to validate that they're not, you know, that they're not abnormal, or that their desires aren't gross or freaky. I mean, there's so much sexual shame in this country that people walk around unable to even own their own desires and fantasies.
Totally.
So I know that I sound like I'm kind of all across the board, like I'm bouncing all over, but honestly, my work encompasses a lot. Mm-hmm. But what it comes down to is that very often, if a person has walls up for any reason, whether they've been bullied or rejected or traumatized in any way, they have blocks to intimacy that will eventually show up physically. And whether that's through sexual dysfunction or a sense of dissociation or any number of other things, awkwardness, you know, if they can experience a sort of if they can experience communication and touch in a safe way, then their brain can sort of be reminded, like, "Oh, I got this. I can do this. I can talk to you. I can hit on. I can touch. I can be with a woman and function normally." I mean, to send, you know, a lot of what I do is send them home with homework. There's a certain mm-hmm. amount of exercises that they're going to have to do at home on their own. And then there are, but even just looking into a woman's eyes and being able to speak openly about sexuality is completely novel to some of my clients, you know?
Mm-hmm. One time I was with somebody who is married, and he just opened up his relationship, and I felt like I was a part of the healing journey when I got to be that kind of person that we could communicate with and have an open kind of sexual relationship with. And it was so empowering, and it was so healing, and it was so good for him too. And then on the other hand, you think about the young guys who are only thinking about their own pleasure and picking up all of their moves from pornography and thinking that that's how a woman wants to have sex or make love. And so it's just this mindfulness piece that I think everybody should really be reminded of, just asking people, is this okay? Is this feel good for you? And it's just communication. It's so important. And you're doing such important work, Kristen. You are so fascinating. And we are just so inspired by you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. I do kind of feel like we're cut from the same cloth. Like, I'm not surprised. First of all, I loved hearing that. Like, you were, because it's not just intimacy coaches or surrogate partners who are doing this type of thing. There's a small segment of the population, some male, some female, who just have a sense. They sort of are in touch with their sexuality, and whoever they're with is affected by that. And some people really need that, need to be affected. And, you know, sometimes just seeing you own your sexuality, if you're in the middle of an encounter, just hearing you communicate your needs gives him permission to do so. But other times, you know, there are some women, you know, there are some people, but frequently women, who just have this receptivity and this empathic nature, so they can pick up on where their partner is feeling a little blocked, and they can kind of nudge him this way or nudge him that way, or open the door, or, you know, bring that out in him or make him feel safe. I think a lot of times men feel their most authentic when they are aroused. It's when they're most likely to take risks and, try harder to open up and just be courageous, and maybe whether that's doing something that they've always wanted to do or saying something they've always wanted to say, you know, because if they have the inspiration of a beautiful woman next to them who's, you know, that's going to be the one thing that's going to be powerful enough to make him move through that fear that's been blocking him. And, you know, there are women all over the world who are doing this here and there who aren't being paid, but, you know, hopefully... I get calls from all over the country. I've had guys come in from out of the country to see me because intimacy coaching is somewhat new, and the bigger cities, you know, all have one or two or three, or like, you know, the Bay Area probably has dozens. But, and hopefully in a few years, you know, there'll be even more. But until then, you know, there are women who've been doing this work just because it's in their nature. Like, clearly, you know, we have, some of us have this... this innate sense of openness and also a sense of safety, and a man can sense that and he'll respond to it. And, you know, you could have changed this guy's life for the rest of his life. His sex is just going to get better and better because he was with someone who allowed him that first sort of foray into authenticity or whatever. You know what I mean? I think it's amazing.
And I think we've pretty much come full circle in terms of, like, you know, being that person who allows people to be their best selves, their open, their authenticity, their creativity, and their connection to creation. So, I mean, I feel like I could talk to you for so much longer. We have so many more questions. You're so multifaceted. And I hope that this isn't the last time that we get to speak with you.
Yeah.
Oh, it's been an honor. This has just been delightful for me. I could talk to you guys forever, too. I feel like I've gone on forever, and I hope I didn't monopolize the conversation. But honestly,
no,
it's
we love it. Yeah. This is a dream conversation for us. Us two, I think that the paths have led here, and this has been one of the most enjoyable things to listen to and ask you about. So thank you for being courageous and open and all of those kinds of things. So we'll just kind of finish off with you, because you, at this stage in your journey, what are you grateful for and what are you getting excited about?
Oh, gosh. Thank you for giving me the chance to say this, because gratitude is so important. And I like to remind myself all the time, because it's so easy to not be grateful. And once the book came out and I realized I was more stressed out than anything, I actually had to have a little talk with myself and say, look, girl, you just did something you've wanted to do since you were 11 years old, and you need to start focusing on the glass half full bit of this. And and all of a sudden, all the little things, like my fears that I might do a clumsy interview, or I might you know what, all the little fears that come up when all of a sudden you're sort of thrust into the spotlight, all that's just sort of disappeared. And even when I feel overwhelmed, like just last night I was feeling really overwhelmed. I had a few things sort of dump on me at the last minute, and I just realized my biggest complaint right now is I have too many good things to do. I have too many amazing things are coming to fruition. And so I'm really grateful above all for my sobriety, because none of this would be happening otherwise. I'm tremendously grateful for all the people in my life who have supported me. Like my sister and my clients have been amazing. You know, these businessmen, I work with a lot of men who are successful businessmen. And when they, you know, hear that, they give me great business advice. And when they heard about the book, and everybody's just been very encouraging. And so I just feel very, very grateful and fortunate for the way everything has worked out. I think I am. What was the other half of that question? I am excited about, you know, continuing along this path with this work. I feel like there's so much more to learn and so much more to impart. There's some new trainings I want to get as soon as I find time, which Lord knows when that's going to be. I know that I have a lot to offer my clients right now. There's some really interesting work being done. Somatica is a certain type of relational coaching. Like right now I'm coaching men only, and in time I would love to be able to start coaching couples and women. I feel like, you know, you have to go with your strengths, and my experience and my affinity has always been to work with men. But, you know, women, everybody can benefit from improved intimacy, I think. And so I just want to get more and more training and continue down this path. I don't know where it's going to lead, but you know, my next book is going to be about it. So expanding my coaching business and writing a book at some point in the next couple of years would be great.
That is amazing. And thank you so much, Kristen, for sharing your story and all of your insight. This has just been such a magnificent conversation. I feel like we're both so inspired right now. And yeah. I'm sure our listeners are going to be just as inspired by you. For any of our listeners who want to check out more about you, where can we find you?
Well, I have a few websites. The book is... it's got its own website, and that is KristenCaseyAuthor.com, and Kristen is spelled with an I-N, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-C-A-S-E-Y, author.com. And then my coaching site is KristenCaseyConsulting.com, and then the surrogate partner site is linked to the coaching site, so you'll find it there, but you can also just go to Surrogate Partner Central Texas if you're interested in that specific aspect of my work. And I think that's... those are my only websites. I see I have so much going on, I don't even know how many I have.
We'll link them up.
Kristen Casey, you're amazing.
You guys are amazing. Thank you so much. I can't tell you, this is so fun. I am going to post all about it. So I can't wait to hear it. And I can't wait to hear more. I listen to your podcast more. I'm not a big podcast listener, but I have listened to yours probably almost as much as any other.
No way.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it.
Well, there you have it. An amazing chat with Kristen Casey, such a champion for women and such an incredible life lived.
We seriously can't wait to see the amazing work she has in store and the other books that she has up her sleeve and possibly some screenplays.
Yes. I love how she speaks about embracing an emotional life, how it's so important to have gratitude.
I know that I'm truly grateful for this interview.
Yes. Make sure to check out all the amazing shows on our network, Rock and Roll Archaeology.
And until next time, Rock and Rollers,
we love you.
Newses and Stuff is produced by Chantal Lemieux and Link Soler. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Please visit rockandrollarchaeology.com for more information.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.